Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I saw this on Twitter today. I don't remember where, but it is kind of apt. NASA has kept its rover going on Mars longer than Airbus is going to be making that double-decker A380. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 13th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is already tomorrow in Beijing, which is where Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin finds himself, and where he and the U.S. trade delegation are set to pick up negotiations over tariffs and intellectual property and forced technology transfer on Thursday, wherever you are. Remember, March the 1st is the deadline that Mnuchin's boss has set for the next steps in the trade war. Elevated tariffs on more goods is what the president has said. So with that in your back pocket, consider this. Any day now, the White House is expected to formally ban the Chinese tech giants Huawei and ZTE from having anything to do with next-generation wireless networks being built in this country. 5G is the nomenclature. Now, remember, Washington has pushed for Huawei's CFO to be extradited from Canada, and it has charged the company with stealing technology from T-Mobile. So again, with trade talks as the backdrop, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains the administration's 5G strategy.
A ban would keep out hardware from firms deemed national security risks. That's code for Huawei and ZTE. The fear is that tomorrow's fifth-generation wireless, 5G, which will link our buildings, power plants, cars, and homes, would also make them hackable. Robert Strayer, the State Department's top cyber official, spoke in D.C. last week.
We have significant concerns with countries that have such a close relationship between their intelligence community and their vendors. Chinese law compels their companies to participate in intelligence activities.
He said the U.S. is making a deliberate push to get allies to follow, especially in Europe. Germany and the U.K. are considering it. And in Barcelona, the mobile industry holds its big annual meeting in 2 weeks. Charles Clancy worked on cybersecurity at the National Security Agency.
The U.S. government intends to use Mobile World Congress as a venue for engaging its allies to essentially offset Huawei's rise to prominence.
Industry will hold its own emergency meetings on Huawei at the conference. The thing is, Huawei is a low-cost and proven titan in the business, says Paul Triolo at the Eurasia Group.
The industry is asking, show us proof of why should the industry be concerned about this? Because within industry, Huawei is viewed as a trusted supplier. You know, globally, it's in 170-some countries.
Today's global supply chain could rip apart if a digital iron curtain goes up, separating countries with Huawei gear from those without it. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The original riveted denim blue jean is headed back to the stock market. Levi Strauss & Company filed paperwork today to go public, the second IPO in the 145 years that Levi's has been around. 1971, in case you're curious, was the first when the denim craze was remaking fashion. But 14 years later, the company was taken private again by Levi Strauss's descendants. So Marketplace's Renata Sago explains why Levi's wants to go public again.
This Levi's ad from 2017 features people dancing in denim. I'm talking high kicks in a field in Africa and shimmies at some club in the U.S. And at the end, three words appear. Live in Levi's. That's exactly why the company's going public now. Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst at NPD. He says Levi's wants all those consumers who've been wooed away from denim by comfy athleisure wear to live in Levi's and Levi's only.
That's going to require a greater level of research and development, introductions into new fabrics, even some experimental, maybe retail stores.
And that's going to require more money, which selling shares would generate. The company earned $5.5 billion in revenue last year, up from the year before, despite depending on struggling brick-and-mortar retailers. Matt Kennedy, an IPO strategist with Renaissance Capital, says that'll be attractive to investors.
They have made some very impressive gains, and I think that's what investors are looking at, to see a company like this that can actually grow despite that environment.
Like a lot of tech firms, the company intends to keep a separate category of shares for its current owners. They will keep control. David Silverman is with Fitch Ratings. He says the challenge is going to be changing company culture.
I don't know that we would say that Levi would expect to operate any differently as a publicly traded entity than a private entity.
Levi's has listed that it hopes to raise $100 million, but the actual number could be much higher. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
A word on inflation in this economy. On course would be that word. Two words, I suppose. One, I guess, if you hyphenate it. From the Labor Department this morning came news that core inflation, that is minus food and energy, was up 2.2% last month from a year earlier. That is just about where Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed want it. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, what do you suppose it takes to make the ski industry get political? Climate change is what it takes. They'll tell you about that tomorrow on the morning show. On Wall Street today, pretty good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back on Monday, it was Boeing taking up the aerospace slot on this program. CEO Dennis Muilenburg and I had a chat. Today, it's Muilenburg's main and really his only competition in the global big commercial airliner market, Airbus, that is getting airtime. The company reports earnings tomorrow, and it is under pressure to address falling demand for its ginormous A380, the big double-decker one. Expectations are, actually, that the world's biggest passenger plane is going to be killed off. The thing only started flying commercially in 2007, a relative blink of an eye in the airliner world. So, from the sustainability desk, Marketplace's Jack Stewart explains why the 380 is on its last wings already.
The Airbus A380 is a beautiful feat of engineering, says John Horrocks at the Center for Aviation Studies at Ohio State University. Its wingspan and length are twice that of the more typical A320 or Boeing 737 that you see at U.S. airports.
But like many, many things that are beautiful or to which our hearts get attached, the market moves in a different direction.
That market is the likes of British Airways, Lufthansa, and the largest customer by far, Dubai's Emirates. It operates over 100 of the super jumbos, but it's reviewing its order for 53 more. Bijan Vassir at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University says although the 747 jumbo jet made bigger look better in the 70s and 80s, the trend is now towards smaller planes.
For airline, filling up 600 passengers is much more difficult than filling up, for example, Airbus A350 with about 300 passengers. Therefore, they take more risk.
Small planes like Boeing's new fuel-efficient 787 also give airlines more options on routes. Airbus didn't comment, but in a Marketplace interview earlier this week, Boeing's CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, said it just highlights the gamble plane builders have to take.
We can never make short-term motivated decisions. We really have to have this long-term strategic view, invest for the future, and it is a big stakes game.
Even if Airbus stops production, the A380 is so new in fleets, it will still be flying for a while. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We've got the whole interview I did with Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg last week in Chicago on our Corner Office podcast. Without trying to guess one way or the other whether the president's going to sign the deal Congress has worked out to not shut down the government again, it is worth a mention of something that is not in the rumored deal. Any protection for Dreamers, people, as you remember, brought to the United States by their parents when they were kids without documentation, but who have become culturally and economically American. There is a flip side to that, too. Kids born in the United States, who are thus citizens, born to undocumented parents, and then those parents have to go back home, voluntarily or not. We're talking Mexico here, in particular. Brooke Jarvis is a contributing writer for the California Sunday magazine. She went to Mexico and talked to some of those kids. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do me a favor, would you? And let's start with Ashley Mantilla, one of the students you talked to. Tell me about her.
So Ashley is a girl who was born and grew up in South Carolina near Greenville. And when she was about 9 years old, the state of South Carolina passed what was then called a show me your papers law, what was referred to that way, that basically turned, routine traffic stops into immigration checkpoints. And Ashley's parents saw the writing on the wall. They also had been interested in returning to Mexico, where they were from, but it had never felt like a real possibility to Ashley or her siblings. But Ashley in particular had refused to learn Spanish when her mother tried to teach her because she said, you know, I'm American. Why am I going to need that?
So she lands in Mexico. They go out. Bus rides away from Mexico City, you say, to where the parents are from. And she's plunked down in the Mexican school system, not speaking Spanish.
Right, which was a really hard transition for anybody. Ashley in particular found it hard because she was so used to being so successful in school, and that, you know, was a big part of her identity. And then all of a sudden the teacher sees her as stupid and is not trying hard enough. And that's something that from educational researchers I spoke to is fairly common. Teachers may not know that they don't speak Spanish because they have conversational Spanish, but they don't read it, they don't write it, they're not ready to learn in it. And so it's very common that researchers will go to schools and say, do you have any American students here? And schools often will say, actually, we don't. We don't have any students like that. And then when they look harder, they may realize they have dozens of students like that.
And in fact, there are, as you say in this piece, best guesses are there are 600,000 American-born, which is to say American citizen children, in the Mexican school system.
And that's an estimate. I mean, there are children who are missed because they don't end up re-enrolled in school because of the paperwork and documentation difficulties. But that number represents something like 3% of the students in Mexican public schools.
So play this out for me as you do in your piece. These people are American citizens. They have the right, whenever they choose, to come back here and work, so they could go through the Mexican school system and come and move to Des Moines. But they would do so without any of the cultural grounding that they would otherwise have.
Right. I mean, they will have missed out on the kind of education they would have gotten in America. Something that can happen with these kids is even though they have that right, they may not know it and they may not believe it. And the idea of coming back and of, you know, paying for college or finding a job can feel incredibly daunting. And in some cases, you know, I met some children who, you know, they were worried that they might do something to lose their citizenship or that they would get in trouble if they did try to reenter the United States, even though they're American citizens.
There's another kid in this piece, and I'm sorry I chuckle, but it's a great little anecdote. Leo, who is was brought back to Mexico by his parents when he was like six. He's 15 now, and he thinks he's an American because he eats pizza. But his mom is like, "No, man, you've got an American passport."
Yeah, Leo is a great kid. Very vocal and thoughtful about what the cultural differences are that make someone American or Mexican.
Does he think he's going to go back to the States? Come back to the States, I guess.
His mom really thinks that he'll come back to the States. Which is something that, you know, when she talks about it, she cries. It makes her sad to imagine, but she also is sad to imagine that he would have his opportunities cut off by not coming back. You know, an example about Leo, he loves math. He wants to have a career in robotics. But at the school where he goes, he's been put in the agricultural program, you know, where you learn to be a small-scale farmer of things like avocados and peaches that grow in this region.
This is a very cold way to think about this, but this is a workforce that could be useful to American companies.
Yes, and if you think about the, you know, the fact that the U.S. has already invested in their education before they left, but then in a way doesn't follow up on that investment, and then another economic way to look at it is, you know, for a society to function, you need an educated workforce and also people who haven't experienced a lot of trauma and dislocation. That, you know, that all will have an effect on what kids are able to do when they grow up.
So we started with Ashley. Let's finish with Ashley. Ashley, she's 15-ish or something now. What's she going to do when it's time for college? Is she going to come back here? Is she going to stay there? What's she going to do? Do you know?
She still doesn't know. Something that I sort of noticed is that they love the idea of coming back until it gets closer, and then it feels much, much scarier and more daunting. You know, in some cases, they have other family members here that they could live with or that could support them. And in other cases, they don't.
It's kind of a fascinating piece in the California Sunday Magazine by Brooke Jarvis. It's called The Deported Americans. Brooke, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've got some pictures of Ashley and Leo, the kids from Brooke's piece, on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APN. Coming up.
You may be going into work every day and wearing a wire and recording your colleagues.
Huh. Okay. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 117 today, 0.4%, 25,543. The NASDAQ up 5 points, less than 0.1%, 7,420. The S&P 500 advanced 8 points, 0.3%, 27,053. There was news we were telling you about Levi Strauss getting back into the public stock market. So here are some other companies in the jeans business. American Eagle Outfitters sagged 1.4%, Gap down 0.1%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.70%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You got, investment-wise, your stocks and your bonds. You got your commodities and your precious metals. You got your jewelry and your classic cars. You got your Beanie Babies, too. They were a bubble back in the 90s. That last one, certainly, is among the more alternative things in which people choose to invest. Hobby investing is sometimes called. A way for people to put a little cash in something that brings them a little bit of joy. But just because it's a hobby does not mean it is immune to the economic tides. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
It's Friday night at a game store in New York called the Brooklyn Strategist. People here are clustered around tables playing a fantasy card game called Magic the Gathering.
You play as wizards who are trying to overwhelm your opponent with beasts that you can summon, and every card in your deck represents spells in your library.
That's Christine Carmack, who runs the store's Magic the Gathering events. It's a bit of an after-school crowd at the moment. Some adult players are trickling in. Carmack says there's more to the game than just playing it.
People will make trades to get cards they want or to try to get more valuable cards because that's just another way of enjoying the game.
It's also a way to make money. The game's been around for 25 years, and some rare and powerful cards are now worth thousands. One card from the original release, called the Black Lotus, sold for $87,000 last year. Sites like QuietSpeculation.com let players trade cards and track prices. MTGStocks.com even has a rolling ticker for the cards.
People have grouped some of the cards that are really popular to invest in and almost track those against an S&P 500 index kind of fund.
That's Seth Robertson, a Magic card investor in Jackson, Wyoming. A couple months back, he says prices on a lot of cards started to drop at about the same time that stock markets got pretty volatile. The two could have been unrelated, but Robertson says he wasn't surprised. Personally, he felt nervous buying Magic cards after looking at his sinking 401k.
You know, it made me kind of take a step back and think, okay, I need to start putting more money into it. Maybe I should stop spending as much on eating out and playing Magic and going to, you know, concerts or whatever.
In an uncertain economy where consumer confidence is falling, hobby investors are seeing weakness. Mike Krause is an artist in Rochester, New York. He paints a lot of landscapes, and he also buys and sells work by other artists. Lately, he says he's seen art buyers hesitate, especially when they've heard news about the trade war with China or the recent government shutdown.
I might have a buyer that will come up to me and say, I'm really interested in purchasing art, but let's just wait and see what's going to happen first.
In fact, he says he'll notice economic trends show up in the art market before they show up in other indicators.
If I have higher sales in January and February, I'll start noticing that, you know, the stock market picks up, the job reports are picking up, so it indicates that things are going in the direction before they actually happen.
Some economic trends can push people into hobby investing. People like Tim McLaren, who started buying up bottles of wine in 2004. Specifically, bottles of expensive Bordeaux. He was betting that an improving Chinese economy would make those wines more valuable. He's now invested $500,000 into wine. That's 10% of his portfolio.
It had done incredibly well from 2005 to 2008. It took a downturn, but it's come back strong.
He tracks prices through an online exchange called BBX, and lately, he says prices have softened. China's economy is slowing down, and there's an even bigger factor scaring buyers, Brexit.
My wines are all in London. There's market risk there.
The UK is one of the world's biggest wine markets, and given that tariffs on wine could go up, McLaren says the market has gotten uncertain. Still, he thinks wine investments will do well in the long run.
That's the whole reason I invest in wine, is I want to resell it to somebody who's going to drink it, and then hopefully my other wine investments do better because there's more scarcity.
And we are talking about hobbies here. If the investments go south, you could play Magic the Gathering, you could admire your art, and you could drink that expensive Bordeaux. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
When you hear about whistleblowing, it's usually a pretty high-profile deal, right? That's why you're hearing about it? Jeffrey Wigand, the guy who went public about what Big Tobacco knew and when it knew it about cigarettes, comes to mind. Fact is, though, whistleblowing is a whole lot more common than just the ones we hear about. It also comes with some costs for the whistleblower. Shilo Kolhatkar from The New Yorker magazine has written a long article laying out some of those costs in a very specific case. Shilo, it's good to have you on.
It's good to be here, Kai.
So let's get the legalese out of the way first here. Talk to me about the process by which some of these whistleblower cases get filed. It's called KITAM.
It's a complicated process, and sometimes it takes years. But essentially, KITAM is a legislation that is intended to encourage people who see wrongdoing, particularly defrauding of government programs, to come forward and report the fraud. So essentially, if you are working at a company and you believe that they are doing something wrong, they're bending the rules,
right,
you would need to kind of find yourself a lawyer. And together, you will sort of investigate and gather evidence and file a complaint with the Justice Department. And the Justice Department is obligated to investigate and at least ascertain whether your claims have some validity. And once they do that for a while, they may decide to join the case. And that's a really big moment. And that basically means that the U.S. government, the
right,
Justice Department, will become the lead plaintiff in the case.
And that gets us, because it all hinges on credibility of the witness, right? Credibility of the whistleblower. It gets us to the protagonist of your article, a guy by the name of Darren Sewell. Tell us who he was.
He began his career as an emergency room doctor. He took a job at a company called Freedom Health, which was administering a special kind of Medicare program called Medicare Advantage. And Darren's job was to help oversee this program and help manage the billing of the program. And he had a very high level of responsibility in the mm-hmm. company, which allowed him to see a lot of what was going on there.
The crux of this piece is the saga of Darren Sewell and this investigation and how lonely it is to be pursuing one of these whistleblower investigations. He was eventually wearing a wire. He was isolated in a lot of ways. It was really hard.
Yes, these whistleblowers really go through the ringer. It is extremely arduous and difficult. There's a sort of perception out there, especially I think in the corporate world, that whistleblowers are motivated by money or that they're even retaliating against the company. But for the most part, a lot of them are just idealistic and they're really upset by the fraud that they see and they want to do the right thing. But of course, you have to agree to keep the case under seal. You cannot talk about it with anyone other than your attorneys and your spouse, if you have one. And other than that, you are going through this incredibly stressful process. You may be going into work every day and wearing a wire and recording your colleagues, you know, worrying about your job and your future, not knowing what's going to happen. And you have to just do all of that alone and not really share that burden with anyone.
I don't want to spoil the ending of this because it's a really good read. So let me not ask about this specific case, but the KITAM process in general, is it doing, based on your reporting, what it was supposed to do, which is encourage sunshine, I guess, into some of these bad acts?
Experts I spoke to about this said yes, having a system to incentivize whistleblowers definitely helps the government catch fraud and abuse of its programs. The numbers are quite mind-boggling. I mean, in 2017, the government recovered $2.6 billion in healthcare fraud judgments and settlements. And $262 million of that was awarded to whistleblowers because they are entitled to a portion of the awards. And I think it's really difficult if you do not have someone on the inside who can really provide evidence and explain, because this is so complicated, some of these frauds, that it makes it really difficult for the government to catch up.
Unless you have somebody, number one, taking the risk, but also paying the personal cost.
Yes. And in many cases, eventually the whistleblower's name becomes public.
Right.
The employer finds out. And in Dr. Sewell's case and in many other cases I learned about, you know, they have trouble finding employment. In
right.
some cases, they can never find another job in the same field. So I think this award program is partly intended to compensate them for their lost income, which, you know, if they're young, that could span over decades.
Shilo Kolhatkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker. We have her on the air on Fridays every now and then to wrap things up for us in a given week. Her piece in The New Yorker about Dr. Darren Sewell and his whole saga is called The Personal Toll of Whistleblowing. Shilo, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, Deja Vu edition. The company that owns MoviePass, the, shall we say, challenged movie ticket subscription service, said this week that it has been delisted from the NASDAQ. Why? Well, in part because shares got to trade above a dollar to be listed on the NASDAQ. At their last close on Tuesday, shares of Helios and Matheson Analytics, 9/10 of a penny. You can still get it over the counter, though. And we are out of here. The Dow up 117 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 5 points, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 up 8, about 0.3% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Breguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.